click on that. Now, yeah, I do believe that the tape is rolling. You're sounding good.
Well, I think it's very nice of you to say so.
So let's do it.
Okay. Hello, I'm Simon Mercip, and this is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film and music, theatre, television, anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and I lately.
Now, we've had a little bit of a midwinter break over the last few weeks because, let's face it, it's, you know, the middle of winter. We've been bopping off around the world doing all kinds of glamorous things, but now we're back, here we are, we're back craving again. Yes. And now, obviously, even though we've not been broadcasting and podcasting, that doesn't mean that we've been resting. There's been plenty. Simon's been posting reviews galore to our website, cravepodcast.com.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I just want to say, Steve, that's been... I've found my writing penchant. Is that
yes,
the word?
Penchant.
Yes, it's been reinvigorated. So I've enjoyed putting some more reviews on the website. And you've actually managed to arrange some fantastic photographs from some recent shows in Auckland. Tell me how that came about, because it wasn't you yourself who managed to grab these shots.
No, it isn't. The Cure happened to play Auckland's Vector Arena the night I got back from Tokyo. And
yeah.
I was absolutely exhausted, completely jet-lagged, and couldn't face the thought of going back out to Vector Arena. And I gather it was an amazing show. But a photography colleague of mine, a young lady by the name of Rachel Van Loyt, has been doing some shoots for us recently. So I asked her if she could cover The Cure for us, and she leapt at the chance.
And she did some great shots, and she's gone on to do another show as well.
She also picked up Lady Hawk for us on this, a couple of nights later at the Power Station in Auckland.
Good stuff. So basically, this, you know, we haven't been doing the broadcasting, as you say, but we've managed to keep things ticking along rather nicely on the website. So the cravepodcast.com website's well worth a visit. A shameless plug on our behalf here.
Well, a plug for us. I think we're allowed to plug our own website that supports our podcast on our podcast. I kind of think that's allowable.
I think so. I don't see any complaints coming our way. Anyway,
I'll check on the podcasting.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, where are we?
This week.
Yes.
This week, we're filming largely, aren't we?
We are, with a bit of a diversion to the stage, but we're going to start with the film, yes.
Should we start with Star Trek? Should we boldly go there?
Okay.
Because you can't refer to Star Trek without using phrases like boldly go, can you?
I know. I'm splitting the infinitive.
Oh, yes.
Great abandon. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So let's do it. Yeah. We've also got, of course, Ghostbusters to talk about.
Yeah, which I wasn't sure if I was going to enjoy it. My expectations weren't that high. I've got to say I was quite pleasantly surprised with that.
I thought it was very, very good. There's a lot to talk about and not simply about the film.
Okay.
It's the first time we've had to talk about the politics of a film, I think, to be honest. But we'll...
Yeah. No, that's a good discussion point.
We'll take it to pieces.
Yes.
Now, you've also been to see films on your own as well.
Yes. I mean, actually, if you look at the films we're looking at here, I mean, Ghostbusters is a remake. Star Trek Beyond is yet another chapter in an ongoing series. And they've just, in the last few days, there's been the latest installment of the Jason Bourne film series, imaginatively called Jason Bourne.
So it's not the Bourne noun?
No, it's just Jason Bourne.
The Bourne Jason.
The Bourne Jason, which I'll talk about a little bit later. All I will say to you is I enjoyed the first three, and I went into this desperately wanting to like it.
Oh, dear. thereby hangs a huge butt.
I know, but we'll save that for a bit later in the podcast.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
But it's not all been doom and gloom, though, has it?
No. I was very, very lucky, and I enjoyed it very much. We got to see the great American comic performer and writer and very frequent Oscar host, Billy Crystal, when he was in Auckland just recently. So, fantastic.
Excellent.
Yeah. But anyway, are we going to kick off with Star Trek Beyond, are we, Mr. McCabe? Shall we go there?
We could boldly go there if you'd like.
Okay, all right.
And so should we set this up a little bit? You know, it's the third in the new, they call it the reboot.
Yes. So
of a franchise that I reckon had increasingly lost its way.
In the franchise goes back to the 60s in television. Then you had... and it's an amazing story, really. And then they bring the same cast back for a series of films at the same time as there are a whole range of offshoots of other Star Trek series involving different characters. So it's a massive universe they've created.
Absolutely.
And then they decide to reintroduce the original characters, but earlier in their careers with different actors. That's basically what's happened in this most recent series of films. And this is the third. Star Trek Beyond is the third in that.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
And it's an attractive little lineup of actors, to be fair. There's some good character actors in there. You've got Chris Pine as James T. Kirk, captain of the Enterprise, obviously.
Yep.
And I think he brings a certain charm to it. You've got Zachary Quinto playing Spock with complete deadpan abandon.
Yes, absolutely deadpan. Yep.
John Cho, who we first saw in Harold and Kumar as Sulu.
Yes.
Zoe Saldana does a lovely Uhura. I'm trying to think who else we've got.
Simon Pegg
as Scotty. He was a co-writer on the on this new film.
Yep, and we must not forget the New Zealand actor in the ensemble.
Carl Urban.
To be Scotty. Bones.
Dr. McCoy. You could forget he was a Kiwi in this film.
You could. And I think you do. Yeah, that he's a Kiwi.
You'll notice that we spent a lot of time talking about the setup here. We spent a lot of time talking about the actors. What have we not talked about yet?
I know the story.
And why not?
Because it's basically the sort of story you have seen every time. Yes.
Thank you. So it wasn't just me.
No. The story. There are no particular surprises in the story, really. Yet another bad guy's on the scene, and they've got to go, you know, the crew's got to boldly go and carry out a heroic rescue or prevent a catastrophe. That part of it hasn't really changed. There's a bit of a difference in the setup, I thought, a little bit, Steve, and I guess they had to find a way to provide what was going to be the spark for the story, because this is the third go at it.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got to find something to do to give the characters a reason to want to do what they're doing. And what they've done here is they've basically said both the main characters, Kirk and Spock, for slightly different reasons, are really, at the beginning of this story, not really sure whether they want to carry on with the Enterprise. I think they feel like they've done their dash, they've seen some space, they've got other things they might want to do, they just want to keep. Do they want to keep on endlessly going out there and exploring new worlds?
It's like a galactic midlife crisis, isn't it?
It is. And so that, I kind of think for me that worked for and against the film. It did give some sort of legitimacy to why we were revisiting this for a third time, but it kind of meant that, I don't know what you thought, Steve. I kind of felt that I was reflecting on this afterwards, that really the characters of Kirk and Spock, I don't know, I felt they were slightly overshadowed by the other characters. Because of this almost deliberate malaise that they were put into by the story, I found the rest of the crew, to me, sparked more with a bit more energy and fire in their belly. And particularly, Bones. I thought Carl Urban had chomped up the scenery no end as Bones in this film.
Well, they really brought him to the fore. If you remember in the original series, one of the main dynamics was the distrust, at least, between him and Spock.
Yes, yes.
And suddenly that relationship was foregrounded very, very prominently in Beyond. And as a result, what's typically considered to be the central bromance in the original series was always Spurk and Cock, wasn't it? I'll take another run at that. Kirk and Spock.
Yes, yes.
You try saying that.
I'll leave it to you.
But that was always the central relationship, wasn't it? That was the primary dynamic in the films.
Yeah, you're right. And what happens here is that switches the bromance. It becomes, as you say, more Bones and Spock. And Bones, Carl Urban, he really becomes, I think, the main comic foil in the film. Previously, Scotty was perhaps more prominently doing that, and he does to a certain extent. But Carl Urban really—he does. He's doing all the asides and giving the light relief. I think more so in this telling of the story.
Yeah, and having a lot of fun with it was a sense I got as well.
Yeah, I he seems to be having the time of his life.
Very definitely.
Yeah.
So this, the story, let's get it out of the way, is the Enterprise picks up a distress signal, as the Enterprise is wont to do.
Yeah.
Picks up a distress signal, goes off, follows it. Turns out that it's all a big setup and they're being played to put the to some sort of MacGuffin into the hands of the big baddie called Kral.
Yes.
Now, that's it. That's basically all there really is, and everything beyond that is commentary. And it, I felt for the entire film that the plot itself was... It was so sketchy that it was basically... It was a second-tier episode of the original TV series with astonishing special effects lathered on top of it.
I can't disagree with that about the plot. I think the plot is almost incidental as for, because the real reason we're all here is to see this group of characters who've been around for decades and many people have grown to love and have a great affection for, to see their interplay again, see their development, see where they are going.
Yes.
And I do agree with you that I was lucky enough to go to a media screening of this, Steve, and it was on the huge screen in Auckland.
The IMAX screen.
The IMAX screen. So the special effects, whoa. There are a couple of scenes, an early attack, assault on the Enterprise, which on that massive screen was woof. Even though we've been talking quite a bit lately, you and I, about how we're getting a bit jaded by all the CGI these days, I've got to say that really was a spectacular and seen and well edited, quickly edited with a lot of pace and intensity, and I thought that was really quite memorable.
Now, you're talking about the scene toward the beginning where there's basically a swarm of small spacecraft.
Yes, that attack the Enterprise, and you see the Enterprise inside and out, really under the hammer, and I thought it was really effective, a great visual sequence.
Yeah, you're quite right. It's a remarkable sequence, and also a lot of the action takes place on a starbase called the Yorktown.
Yeah, and that too, that was quite wonderfully imaginative, and again on a 3D and in a big screen, it took your breath away.
I was quite stunned by that, and I suppose in many ways I was glad to see things to look at because there wasn't really a whole lot to chew on.
No, I can't. You know, I'm trying hard to disagree with you on that, Steve, but I'm struggling. I think you're right. There are a couple of other things we should just mention that they. That anyone who's been following the news, I guess, over recent times would have wondered how they would have dealt with it. The first was the very, very recent death of one of the actors on the film, Elton Yelchin.
Ah, yes.
Who played Chekhov. Now, he died only a few weeks before the film was released, and they didn't have much time really to, I guess, work that in any other way other than in a credit sequence.
Yes, but, there's a passing reference to In Memory Of, isn't there?
Yeah, but the other thing they did have time to consider was the death of Leonard Nimoy, the original Spock, and he died, I guess, well before this film came out. And they did incorporate his passing into the storytelling of this film.
It was a little bit of a cul-de-sac in the storytelling, though, really, wasn't it, to be fair?
Well, whether it succeeded or not, I thought they were trying to use that to explain why Spock, the young Spock, was feeling a bit reflective about reflective and unsure about whether he wanted to continue in the Starfleet.
Yeah, I'll give you that one. I'll give you that one.
But yeah, they you could see they were thinking, oh, we've got to find a way to work this in somehow. So I thought visually great. I still enjoyed the characters. I thought the two usual protagonists, Kirk and Spock, were slightly flat for me and overshadowed, especially by Bones McCoy. And also I thought, used to say, John Cho was very good. And there was the interesting aspect of whether there was a lot of speculation leading up to the release of this film, whether they would... show a member of the crew to be gay, and that was dealt with in this film in a rather tasteful way, I thought.
Very in passing, very matter of fact, very obliquely.
No shouting from the rooftops, just there it is and move on sort of thing. I think that was quite well done.
But
the story-wise, you're not going to have any great surprises, that's for sure.
I do have two little things I want to bring up.
Oh, go on then.
One directly related to film, the title.
Okay.
Beyond What?
Yeah, well,
it's a long time since I've seen a subtitle in a series like this that has told you so utterly little about where the film's going.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, yes, I'll accept that. Yep, yeah. What was the second thing?
Secondly, just a little bit of a rant that I have to have. And I went to see this film. I actually, you know, paid. And
yes.
Because, as I say, I was off jet setting around the world when you were at the press screening.
Yes.
And I showed up, and I. For a 1 o'clock screening, mm-hmm. at, oh, I might as well name them. It was Hoyts was the particular culprit, but I'm sure the rest are getting just as bad. I showed up and I sat through a few minutes of adverts.
Yeah.
And then there were a couple of trailers.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were about 5 minutes more of adverts.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was another trailer.
Right.
Then there was another advert.
Yes.
And the 1 o'clock screening of Star Trek went, well, let's say, beyond 1 o'clock by 20 minutes.
Now, that's really interesting. You said that because I was, this exactly the same thing happened to me when I just recently saw Jason Bourne, but that wasn't at Hoyts. That was at another chain that was Reading Cinemas. I'm not sure if they're owned by the same crowd, but that was a good 20 minutes before the film started. Is this something new? I don't recall that happening quite to that extent earlier in some earlier films.
No, and what got me was the fact that historically it's always been you show the adverts first, get those out of the way, and then you show the trailers. You show the trailers and then you show the main feature.
Yeah.
And obviously people, the management of these cinemas have realised that we've realised that you don't need to show up for the first 20 minutes, or at least the first 10 minutes anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And as a result, they start mixing them in. You know, if you sort of skip the adverts and show up for the trailers, you can't do that any longer. And we're already paying a very, very large sum of money to see these films.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And are you paying to see 20 minutes of a mix of trailers and ads for other companies, is what you're asking me?
Well, rather annoyingly, it appears that yes, I am. I don't like paying for the privilege of being advertised at.
Yeah. And what's interesting also is the number of ads now that are telling you how effective these ads are.
Oh, yes.
So, you know. Yes.
Advertising this cinema, because let's face it, nobody can avoid these bloody adverts. You couldn't, could you?
No.
Yes,
no.
You're quite right. Yeah. Meta-advertising, what a bizarre concept.
So I think that's a good point.
So would we buy a ticket for this film? What do we reckon? Would you recommend people pay to see this?
If you are a Star Trek fan, yes. If you've never seen a Star Trek movie, which perhaps is not that many people, I still think visually you're going to be entertained, and there's enough, for want of a better word, action and a dash of humour here and there to probably make it a decent, evening's entertainment. It's not breaking any new boundaries here. It's not perhaps taking this whole franchise in a completely new direction whereby you're thinking, oh my gosh, what are they going to do next? I mean, I think really what they've done is to say we're going to keep doing what we've been doing all along. So from that point of view, it's a little bit of a letdown. I would concede that. But yeah, it's still a good night out.
I think what you're actually trying to say is it's not boldly going where no Star Trek film has gone before.
That's absolutely what I'm saying.
I think that's where we're going with this, isn't it?
Right.
I'd save you money. Seriously.
Save your
money and spend it on instead.
You're going to tell me Ghostbusters.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll move on to that. By the way, this is Crave, and he's Steve McCabe, and I'm Simon Mercip, and you can listen to us on a regular occasion on our podcast and go to our website, cravepodcast.com. So, Steve, Ghostbusters, this is the all-female crew version of the 1980s film? It was 80s, wasn't it?
Early 80s, yes. And it was, obviously we remember the first film with great affection, don't we?
Yeah, we do. It was funny, it was jokey, it was in a good way. Some classic characters who probably we all, the likes of Sigourney Weaver and Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd. And so, yeah, they made an impact at the time. And I suspect for a lot of people they have fond memories of that story. And so this time we've got four women. Melissa McCarthy, Kristen Wiig, Kate McKinnon, Leslie Jones, they are the ones out there doing the busting. And you've also got a male foil. I was going to say ably assisting them. Perhaps he's not that ably assisting them, but he's their secretary, Chris Hemsworth.
Yes.
And then you've got a bunch of other, really good actors, Charles Dance is there and others, and a very liberal dose of some surprise or perhaps not so surprising cameos, and I won't say any more of that right now. So anyway, so it's a great mix. Steve, what I want to know from you is, what did you expect going into this film, and did you actually get out of it what you expected?
Well, I was very, very careful to find out very, very little about this film before I went in, because all I'd seen was that much of the discussion that was going on was, from what I could tell from headlines that I read, and I tried to avoid reading any deeper than that, much of the discussion was profound misogyny and intolerable racism, thinly disguised as valid criticism. And I thought, I just don't really want to bother with that. I'll just go in with fresh eyes.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of glad I did, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. I was vaguely aware of that too, and I tried not to pay too much attention to that. So this is really a comedy, isn't it? I mean, let's be clear about it. How much did you laugh?
A lot.
Good.
I mean, I'm sure you're the same, aren't you? I mean, it's consistently funny, right?
It is. No, I mean, there were... I'll let you just pick up the storytelling thing, but I'll just say there were some scenes where I laughed out loud a lot.
Definitely.
In fact, some of the funniest scenes I've seen for quite a number of movies. Not all the time. For me, there were a couple of periods where it was slightly formulaic.
Yeah.
And for me, anyway, a couple of the characters made more impact than a couple of the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Kristen Wiig, am I saying her name right? I don't know if it's Wiig or Wiig, I don't know. I thought she and Leslie Jones, who's the subway attendant who joins the crew, the black woman who becomes the fourth member, I thought they were really, really good. I thought Chris Hemsworth became an excellent foil. And for me, though, Melissa McCarthy and Kate McKinnon didn't quite do it for me, but that, I don't know, that's just my own take. But anyway, you get the ball rolling a bit more with what your thoughts, please, Mr. McKay.
We'll do the story very quickly. And if you've seen the original Ghostbusters, then you've got a decent clue of the outline of this story. You've got Kristen Wiig plays a university professor, physicist at Cornell University, who suddenly finds a book that she'd written many years earlier in her younger days come back to haunt her, a book about ghosts. And it's been put back on the internet by Melissa McCarthy's character, who is a B-list or C-list academic at a very, very dodgy institute, who's trying to do research into the paranormal with her assistant, played by Kate McKinnon. And then they little by little start to find out, much as happened in the original film, that there are alleged paranormal activities happening across New York, and they start exploring them. They then find some things happening in the subway stations, and so they're open Leslie Jones, who's, as you say, is a subway attendant, to help them further. And things just spiral out from there. You get the great big huge rampage of ghosts across New York for the big climax, and that's basically it. In many ways, it's a gender inversion, and that was done quite pointedly, we know now, of the original.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's it. I mean, the story isn't any great shakes. It's a loose reworking, a very, very loose, in many ways, reworking of the original story. It's not about the story, though, is it?
No, it's really about the pleasure of revisiting some characters in different genders, but, you know, the same sort of mix of characters, how they spark off each other, the humour, the camaraderie, the jokes, the visual jokes, the scripting, the paying homage to the original, which they do well, don't they? They actually bring back some of the characters, even some of the ghostly characters from the 1980s reappear in this telling.
In fact, you can sit there watching the film going, oh, see that bit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You can tick them off, and I have a feeling if I went back to see it a second time, and I am tempted to.
Ah, okay.
I would probably see, I mean, certainly in the car on the way home, I saw this with my wife, my teenage daughter, and my mother-in-law.
Right.
Everyone enjoyed it. On the way home, people say, well, and you saw that bit, right? No, I missed that.
Okay.
There was a lot of background detail that was callbacks to the original film.
Yeah. What I did like about it, Steve, is I guess my expectations were a little bit low, and I was thinking, gosh, is this really just a bit of a rehash for the sake of, you know, trying to churn out some money? But it didn't feel like it. Even though it was clearly drawing on the well of the first film, it had a freshness about the telling, which I thought made it overall very enjoyable. Flat, a little bit flat here and there for me, but that's, you know, minor. I have to say, in particular, the scene, we're talking about the humour of it, the scene where the Chris Hemsworth character goes for his job interview.
Oh, my wife was howling with laughter.
It was so funny. And Kristen Wiig and Hemsworth just bounced off each other beautifully, and it was just a wonderfully funny scene. And Leslie Jones, I thought also, because there was a new, she was also very good. What did I told you, I wasn't so taken up with Melissa McCarthy and Kate McKinnon. How did you think those characters worked for you?
Well, I kind of took against Melissa McCarthy. If you remember back in episode 17, I reviewed The Boss.
Oh, yes, yes.
Her vehicle, which I thought was unpleasant to the point of being offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Largely due to the fact that it was a Melissa McCarthy vehicle, and she just wasted the opportunity she was given and churned out something absolutely appalling. And I think partly because of that recent experience of her, I couldn't quite warm to her in Ghostbusters, although I can see why some people might view it with a bit more affection than I did.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right about Kristen Wiig. She was fantastic.
Yeah. And what about the zany scientist Kate McKinnon? How did that work for you?
I loved her.
Okay.
I thought she was fantastic. I think I've used this analogy previously, I think possibly even with regard to The Boss. It's one of those things where if you have a character like that, then you need to use them very, very carefully as seasoning.
Yes.
You can't build the entire film around them because that just overwhelms. But what you do is you sprinkle them around a little bit, just as a little bit of, flavour, really. And I think they used her very, very well. I think they gave her just enough to stop. I don't think she crossed the line to being irritating.
Okay, I think my line was crossed, but hey, that's all right. I'm not sure why. I know what she was trying to do, that sort of intense, zany, scientific bent. I just didn't quite connect to it, but that's okay. But I have to say, just on that type of idea, I kept on wanting to see more of Chris Hemsworth than I did.
Yes.
Because I did, and it left me wanting more, which I guess is a good thing, right?
Well, better than wanting less.
Yes, yeah. Now, he's got quite a good comic turn.
He does, surprisingly. You get the impression he was having a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is nice to see. Now, I do want to talk about, obviously, the sexual politics of the making of this film have been rehashed a million times. And if you want to make a film that shows that women can do this kind of thing perfectly well, I do find myself wondering why simply remake an old film? Why not do another one, a new one from scratch? That's a story, that the conversation that could be thrashed to bit pieces.
Yes.
But the racial policy... Go ahead.
No. I think that's fair. I mean, I mean, maybe in a way you could look at it and say the fact that Hollywood, who's Hollywood? The writers said, let's take a story which was well known as A Bunch of Blokes and let's turn it on its head and let's still churn out something that's entertaining and use some of the flip the usual gender roles, and it's a spunky bloke who's being interviewed by a bunch of women type thing and do all that in reverse and that's all good and it worked and it was funny, but yeah, that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be as you say, something fresh and new at which involves female characters, absolutely. Yeah.
And certainly with regard to the fact that the characters were female, I didn't care. They were good characters.
Yeah, exactly.
Not a big fan of Melissa McCarthy, but that's because of who she is, not because of the fact that she's a lady. It's just that she annoys me. But the other three, fantastic. I was very, very taken with them. But I did notice that you got Melissa McCarthy's character, Kate McKinnon's and Kristen Wiig's characters are scientists. They're engineers. Mm-hmm. They're academics. These are brilliant women.
And they're all white.
And they're all white. We have one black woman. Is she allowed to be an engineer? No. She takes tokens in a subway station. Because we can handle having black scientists and engineers. We can handle women scientists and engineers. But we're not quite ready yet for a black woman scientist or engineer. That's clearly just a little bit more than we're comfortable with just yet.
Okay. Just thinking about that. I mean, I suspect, I don't know the New York subway system well enough, but I suspect that there's a pretty good chance that you might well find a black woman working in the New York subway system. I mean, that's probably not unrealistic to have that happen, but
I'm sorry, this is Ghostbusters. We're focusing on very similitude, seriously.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, I was about to say, but I think that's a fair point. I mean, I was, as you were saying that, Steve, I was just trying to quickly rattle through my brain to think if I could come up with any other stories recently where that has actually happened and you've had a, one of the brains of a story, or the driving force of a story, is a black woman. And I'm sorry, I just can't quite think of one right now, but maybe that's the point.
I mean, this one, as I said at the very start, yeah, buy a ticket. I'm tempted to go and buy another ticket. I enjoyed it that much.
It was good. It was entertaining. It was funny. It was kind of refreshing in a way you didn't expect it to be, and I would agree with that. Yep. Well, yes, well said. Well said.
Now, one that you saw that I didn't get a chance to see, and I don't know it's really my thing anyway, to be honest, is, what are we calling this, The Bourne Jason.
Yeah, The Bourne Jason, yes. So, that yeah, I was a fan of the first three. I liked them. I particularly liked the way the British director Paul Greengrass did the second and third. You know, he had brought a lot of pace and intensity to the telling of the story, and the editing was really snappy. And I always thought that those Bourne movies perhaps in some way laid the ground for the reinvigoration of the Bond franchise.
Yes, very definitely.
I think so. I did like those three. And I went into this one, as I said at the beginning, hoping to like it too, as a smart and an innovative next chapter in the life of Jason Bourne. And it had to be, because the last film pretty much resolved the major questions that were haunting Jason Bourne. You know, he's this brainwashed government assassin. And we see in the first three chapters, he's struggling to come to terms with all these people he's killed. How did he get into this program? Why did he get into it? And pretty much we kind of got the answers to that by the end of the third film. So where would they go? Where do you take this in an intelligent and interesting way? But could I just before I leap any further, Steve, are you saying, did you see any of the first three films at all?
I did see the very first one, which, if I recall, was The Identity.
Yes, yes.
And you're absolutely right. You can see how it reset the agenda for films of that ilk. And you can see the fingerprints of it all over the Daniel Craig era James Bonds.
Yeah.
Especially the very first one, Casino Royale. You can definitely see that there's a change of tone. Mm. And the thing that obviously came between the old school Bonds and then Craig was Bourne. And you can definitely see how Bourne drove the development of the tone of the Bond franchise.
Yep.
But at the same time, I watched the first one and I felt it to be very, very formulaic. It lacked the spark. I mean, it was well directed, it was fast, it was zippy, but character. Maybe it's because of Matt Damon. I don't know. I am given to liking his work usually, but I just didn't quite find him pushing my buttons.
Okay. Well, let me just say, first of all, the first film was directed by a bloke called Doug Liman, I think his name is.
Yes.
And it was the second and third which were directed by the Greengrass.
Yes.
And you visually, the second and third are different. He does this, the way they're edited and shot is even pacier than the first. And
right.
There are some absolutely standout action sequences and fight scenes which are just gripping. And I think probably I grew to like the story more after having seen the second and third. But the challenge was there. Could they come up, even with Greengrass back, with Matt Damon back, could they come up with a good way of taking this forward? And I don't think they quite did it, sadly. I think that they do find another part of the character's backstory to justify this fourth film, and they bring back one of the previous characters, a woman called Nikki Parsons, and she's involved in sort of kickstarting this new story. And again, it's all to do with how did Jason Bourne get into this program and who is responsible for this dark side of the CIA. So they come up with a way of doing it. It's not really clear, though, why so much time has passed between the two, the previous film and this film, as to why it's all happened now and why this particular character, Nikki Parsons, is involved in it. She's played by Julia Stiles, who does a good job. So that was a bit of a question that didn't quite sit well with me.
Well, just go back to Julia Stiles for a second. I've always had the feeling in the past that she's something of a lightweight, and she doesn't belong in a film alongside the likes of Matt Damon and Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, no. I disagree. No, I think she. No, I think you should go back and see the third. Both the, she's in the second and the third films. I thought she was really good. She because she keeps it really low key.
Yeah.
And there's a tension between her and Bourne that I think works really well in the first two. The second and the third.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll disagree with you on that. But
not having seen it, I'm willing yes. to be wrong on that one.
Oh well,
for her sake.
Yeah, for her sake. But here's the thing, Stephen. This is the thing that I think most people watching this will be saying to themselves. Once the story does get going, we see a lot of what we've seen before. And what I mean by that is we see the similar settings across Europe. We see similar types of characters at the CIA. We see similar set pieces in the action. We even see similar scenes, even when it's not an action sequence. And I'll just mention one. There's a brief scene on board a train, which is almost exactly the same as a scene from the previous film. Then you've got all the theme music, and the incidental music is all the same. So clearly this is deliberate. Clearly it's intentional. And I was asking myself, why is it so similar? They've done it on purpose. Are they trying to say that if you're writing a story about a guy called Jason Bourne who's this assassin, that his life is just a never-ending repetition of the same tensions and dangers, and he's caught on a treadmill, and that's it. And maybe if you accept that, maybe that's okay. But
so he should have been called the Bourne Groundhog.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could see a number of people looking at this and saying, well, you know, this really does regurgitate what we've seen. I think there is, you know, there's clearly a plan here. They've done it on purpose. I don't think it's done out of laziness. It's a deliberate attempt to say, hey, this guy is caught, and he's like it's a groundhog. And I mean, the actors are good. I think Matt Damon is fine. Tommy Lee Jones is, you know, Tommy Lee Jones. He can do a good job. There's a new young and up and coming CIA person called Alicia, who's played by Alicia Vikander, who does well. And that French actor Vincent Cassel, he's the Jason Bourne's chief protagonist here in the field. So they're all good. It's just an odd decision to make it so much like the look and feel of the others, with really just a bit of a tweak to the backstory to justify this fourth film. And I kept on thinking, oh, there's going to be something else here, because these are all smart people. They're smart filmmakers. They want to come up with something which is really worthwhile. I just don't feel it quite did that. It wasn't a disaster by any means, but it just didn't quite snap me to think, yeah, wow, they've really done something really interesting with this.
So I guess if we're going to ask the question, would you buy a ticket for this, then it's a slightly more complex question this time, because you'd also have to ask, would you buy a ticket for the first three to catch up? I get the sense it's not worth investing that much time in, but is it worth going to see it on its own right?
I think if you wouldn't get – that's a good question, because if you have seen the first three, you understand a lot more about the tone and the pace and the telling of the story, and you understand some of the backstory as well. But if you haven't seen the first three, you're maybe more likely to see it as a fresh story, and you're more likely not to think of it as just as regurgitation.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
I was curious. I was so curious to see what they were going to do with the actual plot. That was me. Would they just be seeking a cash cow here? Would it be just to get the bucks and run? I think that they made an attempt not to do that.
Okay.
But I'm just not quite sure if it worked. So what am I saying? I think I would still have bought a ticket because my curiosity factor was so high that I would have gone to see it. And in fact, I did pay to see it. But, slightly deflated, which was disappointing.
Well, you've not convinced me to buy a ticket.
Okay, fair enough. What I would say to you, if you've got a spare rainy afternoon, I recommend you do catch at least one of the preceding films directed by the British director Paul Greengrass. Because it does, the second or the third would be, I'd be interested to see what you had to say about that.
Well, considering today's looking like one of the rainiest and miserablest Sunday afternoons we've had in Auckland in quite some time, that might just be where I go.
Okay, very good. Now
speaking of places we've been.
Yes.
Simon,
yes.
You lucky dog.
I know. I won't dwell on this too long because it's been a little while since he was here, but I was very lucky to get to see Billy Crystal, Steve.
Yes.
Who's got such a familiar face to us, hasn't he? We've, around the world, he must be one of the most recognisable entertainers on the planet, having hosted the Oscars for, was it 9 years? Been in lots of films. So he came to Auckland for a couple of shows. And what is interesting about this was the type of show we got to see. I mean, I don't know what would you expect to see, Steve, if you thought, oh, I'm going to go see Billy Crystal? What's he going to give me? What would you think?
He's a comedian.
Yeah.
So how does a comedian perform? You stick him in front of a microphone stand and they do an hour and a half of stand-up.
Yeah. You probably might think that. Well, this is quite a different take on that. And it's really interesting and it gives a whole different feel to it. What it is, there's two armchairs on the stage.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not just Billy Crystal, but an Aussie broadcaster called Andrew Denton.
Ah, yes, I'm familiar with the name.
Okay, so those two guys are... Andrew Denton is almost interviewing Billy Crystal, but really he's just prompting him
right.
to tell particular chapters from his life story. So what we see is a couple of guys very relaxed on stage, sitting in their armchairs, but Billy Crystal sometimes answering Andrew Denton directly, but more often turning to the audience, telling his story to them, either seated or standing, and all this interspersed with some video footage up on a big screen behind them, illustrating some people and some characters and stories from his career. It's incredibly low-key. I mean, you feel like you could be just in the sitting room and Billy Crystal's across on another armchair with you, and he's so relaxed. I called my review on our website, Steve, Mr. Natural. He's unfussed. He's comfortable. He's just catching up with a few mates. It's incredibly intimate. I mean, he does that very, very well. It doesn't feel like it's scripted or, you know, that he's done it a million times. I don't know how many times he has done it, but he's clearly got this material down to a fine art. And it has the feeling not necessarily of a show.
Okay.
It's in a way, it's a little bit, it takes you to a different place. But I think he is so, it's hard not to like him. He's so unprepossessing. He's generally quite self-effacing, you know. The whole thing is telling about all these amazing people he's met and amazing things he's done in his show business career. It doesn't feel like it's just him saying how great I am. It's just, here's this guy, he's 68, he's on top of his craft, he's got a wonderful sense of timing, he can read the audience really, really well, and you're just drawn into this conversation. So I think that worked very, very well. And what the show is just him just trotting through his career, starting from, you know, his family, how he got into it, how he got his first big break, some of the big names he met along the way, the friendships he's made. Some of his early performances. It's just, yeah, here's my life. There's a few visual illustrations along the way. It's not all funny. His discussion about Muhammad Ali is very touching. He spoke at Ali's funeral, and that was great. His friend, late friend Robin Williams. So there's a lot of comedy, but there's a lot of pathos as well. And he is, but he's got this light touch that's just, which means he's, I don't know, do you think he's just maybe sometimes too much of a nice guy, Steve? Does that ever come across to you?
He does seem a bit relentlessly, he's clearly very sweet. Possibly, I can see why you're suggesting that he occasionally drifts into saccharine.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, he's a bit more adult in his use of language in front of a live audience. There's a few F words thrown around here and there, but it's done, you know, it all seems quite appropriate. But there's a couple of times when he tells stories where he's talking about people who he didn't get on with or who he had some sort of a disagreement with. He mentions Orson Welles. He mentions
right.
Charles Bronson. And the initial telling of those stories are like, ooh, these guys have sounded a bit mean and nasty, you know. How dare they get on the wrong side of Billy Crystal? But later on, there's another little addendum whereby he sort of softens the criticism a little bit. So it's almost like he can't help but want to build fences. I guess some of the things you'd expect to hear him talk about when Harry met Sally, and he does. You'd expect to hear him talking about the Oscars, and he does. One thing, Steve, I thought, given this is a New Zealand audience and given he was the host of the Oscars when Peter Jackson and the third Lord of the Rings film had that incredibly successful year, that might have somehow worked its way into his script that night, mm-hmm. but it didn't. So I was mildly disappointed at that. It's not a big thing, but I just thought there was an opportunity to make a connection with the local audience there.
Right.
What he also shows is, just quickly, there's a bit of interplay with the audience where he's clearly having to respond on, you know, impromptu to what people say, and he's wonderful at that. That's some of the best parts of the evening, and it just shows you he's still got his wits about him.
Right.
He can read people and get a nice laugh out of them. So overall, a really polished, professional, relaxed, engaging evening. If he ever did come back again, I don't think you'd be disappointed.
No, I was disappointed I had to miss it. I think it's testimony to his cross generational reach that I mentioned to my mother-in-law that we'd been offered tickets to review this show, and I had to decline, and you scored them instead. She said, "Well, you boogie, you should have taken me."
Yes.
He clearly appeals across an enormous range, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the Muhammad Ali thing was interesting. How he connected with this one of the most gifted athlete, a big black Muslim guy, and he's a small white Jewish guy. You know, there's something about his manner and who he is that seems to be appealing to people from all walks of life. And he looks like he's still got a bit of life in his entertainment bones yet. That's for sure.
Yeah, well, let's hope he makes it out here again.
Yeah, it's all good. Hey, so we've been we're having a good yarn today, Steve. We had a bit to catch up on, didn't we? But there's a lot coming up soon as well, isn't there?
There is. There's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff coming up soon. There's some good local homegrown material coming up soon.
Yeah, there's been a couple of. I missed it at the New Zealand Film Festival, but I know that there's been a documentary on one of the most famous popular songs that this country's put out in modern times, Poirier.
Yes.
And a documentary's been made on that. And I think that film is coming back for general release, I think, quite soon. I think that would be well worth seeing. I'll be keen to see that. And actually, in the Jason Bourne film, Steve, there was a trailer for this documentary on the recently retired triumphant All Black captain Richie McCaw.
Yes,
with a subtle title, Chasing Great, is the title. I mean, that apparently has got lots of access to his family, and it could be interesting. The trailer looked interesting, and it could be the sort of film I think many people around the rugby world, so like in places like Britain and France and Australia, perhaps, you know, there'll be interest offshore. I think that's not out yet for a little while, but the trailer is out and about, and looks like it's something to keep an eye out for.
Well, definitely one worth bearing in mind. We've also got coming up, and it's a slightly more lowbrow end of the spectrum, I suppose, but let's face it, this is the northern summer, so all the big summer blockbusters are coming out.
Yes.
And so we've got Suicide Squad opening next week, which looks like it could be fun.
Yeah, well, I don't know much about. I know this is a DC comic based film. Maybe I'm being too PC, but the title. I know that's apparently the original title was Suicide Squad, but gosh, I don't know. I am put off by something called Suicide Squad, I've got to say. But however,
we shall find out.
That's
opening next week. So yeah. We'll definitely give that one a look.
Yeah.
There's also some interesting music coming up. I realise I'm using the word interesting loosely here, possibly. Selena Gomez is coming to Auckland in about 2 weeks' time. She's from the Disney stable, and she's now making a name for herself in her own right, has been for a couple of years. She's playing Vector Arena on the 13th of August.
Yeah, okay.
Possibly... the opposite end of the spectrum from her, a fortnight later, Slipknot.
Now, I don't know much about Slipknot. Tell me about Slipknot.
Take your earplugs.
Right. Okay. That covers it. Thank you.
I think their name tells them about all you really need to know.
Yeah. Right.
Not. I'm not sure it's completely my cup of tea either. But from what I gather, they put on an astonishing spectacle. So I'm hoping at the very least we can get photographs of the show.
Okay. That'll be good. That'll be good.
Looking a bit further ahead, end of November, we've got the Monkees.
Really?
Well, we've got
how many of them?
Two.
Two.
There were four. One died. One is possibly not as active with the touring as you'd like. But yeah, it's looking like we've got, I believe it's Mickey DeLenz and Peter Tork are the two who are actually coming, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
And they're going to be in Auckland and in Christchurch at the end of November.
Gosh, I wonder what sort of show they'd put on. That's, yeah.
Well, they did release a new album just recently.
Okay.
That was very, very good. A lot of it was stuff that was written back in the 60s. And some of it was actually recorded in the 60s as one song. It's actually got Davy Jones's vocals on it.
Wow.
And it's astonishingly good fun. It reeks of the 60s.
Yeah, as it should.
Yes, absolutely. It is the Monkees, after all. And it reeks of the 60s and it reeks of sunshine.
Wow. Okay.
So I'm hopeful for a good show there. And then also one that's also worth mentioning later in October is Bill Bailey.
Oh, okay. Yep.
The British comedian.
Yes.
He's going to be at the ASB Theatre in Auckland on the 26th of October.
Okay. Good. Good. And I'll just mention just quickly, Steve, a few episodes back, I did an interview with an up-and-coming Auckland musician called Miller.
Yes.
And we put some links on our website to his brand new first ever EP.
Yes.
And he's got an Auckland show coming up next week. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of August, in the hold on, where am I? The Golden Dawn?
Yes, Tavern of Power. Right. Yep.
Yeah, so, and it's free entry. So I'm going to do my best to tag along to that and report back. We talked a bit about his recorded debut, and I'm interested to see how he gets on in front of a live audience. So I'll give you a bit of insight.
And if I'm not mistaken,
yeah.
This is going to be his first show with an actual full band backing him.
Ooh, okay. Well, that could make it quite memorable then.
It could indeed.
Lovely. All right, so that's good. A lot to keep us interested over the next few weeks. It's good to be back in the chair, in the saddle. Is that the word?
We'll take it. Yeah,
okay. So this has been Crave. If you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email to podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook or you can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
Lovely jubbly. So I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Excellent.
Well, it was quite a long chat, but we had a lot to get through.